From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's been 10 years since the groundbreaking Earth Summit in Rio de Janeiro. Delegates left Brazil with a game plan to tackle global warming, preserve biodiversity, and stop pollution. But the environmental concerns of a decade ago are still with us, and on almost all fronts, the situation has worsened. Next week, the successor to Rio convenes in Johannesburg. What have we learned? Will we survive? We begin tonight with the story behind former Enron executive Michael J. Copper's guilty plea in Houston yesterday. Prosecutors have answered impatient citizens and politicians with Copper's damning testimony of paying kickbacks and using bogus partnerships to defraud Enron of millions. Mary Flood has been following the trial for the Houston Chronicle. I asked her if anyone saw this plea bargain coming.
There were noises being made. It reminds me of the Mel Gibson movie Signs, where the baby monitor starts getting louder and louder. In the last week, those of us who've been watching this knew there was something going on, had an indication somebody might be pleading out. So it wasn't a complete surprise.
What do prosecutors think now that they have Michael Copper cooperating so extensively? How big a breakthrough is this, and where might it lead them?
It could lead them to the top. They have clearly been working their way up, and I'm not sure that prosecutors think anything differently from today than they thought yesterday, because they've known all along what's going on. They're the ones with subpoena power. They're the Cheshire Cat here. They know they've been working hard. I suspect they've been like an octopus lurking on all sorts of different things, and we're seeing one tentacle come out of the water here with these three partnerships and Mr. Copper's plea that clearly points to the former Enron CFO, Mr. Fastow.
What are the main elements of what we've heard from Copper's plea so far that shed light on where this investigation may go?
Copper's plea and the information filed by the government repeated the term Enron CFO possibly even dozens of times. And it was very specific and very clearly written. And it was obvious that the government had spent a lot of time with Mr. Copper and knew exactly who had put in money, who had gotten the ill-gotten gains, where they have gone. And, you know, we expect them to go after that money now with forfeitures.
Now, is the standard technique then to flip one suspect after another? Can they go up the food chain now and try and get Andrew Fastow to cooperate and testify against Ken Lay?
They could certainly try that, absolutely. There have been rumors, increasing rumors, that Mr. Fastow might be interested in the plea bargain. Who knows? You can never tell what he can give up. But yes, it is classic prosecutorial strategy to flip somebody kind of in the middle so that they have enough information on the people further up. Mr. Copper may be flipped and may be cooperating, but he still is giving up $12 million now and may give up a great deal of his freedom when he's sentenced.
What kind of jail sentence is he facing, or has he been absolved of?
He's facing up to 15 years in the federal penitentiary.
It's a long time. Tell us about Michael Copper. Where exactly did he stand in the Enron hierarchy? What was his job? And what was he in on that apparently went wrong?
Well, Mr. Copper was largely an assistant to Mr. Fastow at some point, and he was known as a fairly brilliant man, and the two of them set up a number of partnerships, probably designed mostly to beef up Enron's bottom line. But they then used them, according to the federal government in the charge yesterday, they used them to enrich themselves, their friends, and their family, while helping Enron look like a bigger company than it was.
How is this going down in Houston? Are people nodding their heads and saying, yeah, of course, this is what we thought was going on, or are the surprises here?
I don't think Houston's surprised, but I don't think Houston was as impatient as perhaps some of the politicians in Washington have been. People think Houston's devastated by this, and we aren't. Housing prices are still fine. People are getting jobs. Enron was big here, but it's not the huge loss that people think. Arthur Andersen's all but closed here as well. But we are still just going on. You know, you pay at the gas station, and we'll be fine, basically, here in Houston.
Keep the oil pumping. And what about the rest of the executives or former executives with Enron? How many could conceivably be in the prosecutor's sights here?
I would assume dozens of people are in the prosecutor's sights.
All the way up through Andrew Fastow and Ken Lay, CEO and chairman?
Oh, certainly. Mr. Lay is somebody they're considering. Mr. Lay's criminal lawyer, Michael Ramsey, a top-notch criminal lawyer here in Houston, told us yesterday that he has been talking to prosecutors about, for instance, some loans that Mr. Lay was given from the company. And lawyers like Mr. Ramsey are smart enough to go and tell their client's side to the prosecutors when they know the prosecutors are looking at their clients.
Michael Copper has given up $12 million that he's forfeited at this point. Is that all of his wealth? And beyond him, if this goes to other executives, how many millions of dollars might Enron executives eventually be coughing up, giving back?
I don't know. We're talking about, you know, tens of millions, obviously, because they're already seeking to forfeit, I suspect, not just the $23 million or so that was listed in the information yesterday, but well more than that. And as for how much money Mr. Copper has, I don't know. But he will be fined, likely, in addition to getting some prison time, should that be what the sentence is. So he's probably not totally broke, though his attorneys should be costing him quite a bit right now.
Finally, Mary Flood, what's the sense of people watching this up close? Does it look like just a good old-fashioned aggressive investigation of a company gone wrong, or does there seem in the minds of Houston people to be an element of show trial here?
I'm not sure Houston people are any different than anybody else on this, but there was certainly some show. Mr. Copper yesterday came in the courthouse in the back and came out the front. Now, maybe that was a strategic decision by his attorneys to show some remorse, which is what his attorneys said, that he was sorry. And maybe that was his apology to the people of Houston and the company and all the shareholders and all the retirement funds that lost money because of what he and his colleagues did. But it wasn't the show that we've seen on the East Coast. It wasn't the show that we've seen with the handcuffs, and it was done somewhat more gentlemanly. That may be Houston there that you're seeing.
Maybe a little touch of Houston culture in a sad story. Mary Flood, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Mary Flood is a reporter for the Houston Chronicle. She spoke with me earlier today from Houston. Summer floods and landslides this year killed nearly 1,000 people in China, more in India, more in Bangladesh. The floods in Central Europe have been called the worst in over 100 years. The American West has been ablaze. Fish stocks are plummeting. The world can feel these days like a nonstop environmental crisis. Put it together with global warming, a population headed toward perhaps 11 billion, and punishing malnutrition, and the 21st century can look like a candidate for environmental meltdown. But is it? Could it be the green century? On Monday, delegates and world leaders convene in Johannesburg for the World Summit on Sustainable Development to assess how far we've come to repairing the damage and where we go from here. What is your prognosis for the planet's health in this century? Is there still hope for clean air and water? Do we risk a living hell here? Or can we turn the corner? Can Johannesburg and all we've learned make a difference? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us tonight in the studio is Adil Najam, Professor of International Environmental Policy at Boston University. Good evening and welcome, Adil Najam.
Thank you.
Great to have you. Also with us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
Adil Najam, there's a lot to talk about tonight. We know that the people are gathering from all over the world in Johannesburg, South Africa. There was a great stir in Rio 10 years ago, and I'm sure that we'll hear a lot of news out of Johannesburg coming up. We'll dive into all that, but take us, if you dare, to the bottom line first, because we've learned, I think, in some way to shove this to the back of our minds and not really face it straight on if we don't have to. What are we looking at in the century ahead, the century that our children and grandchildren will live in? Are we looking at a kind of an awful fry-and-die living hell scenario here if things don't change in a major way or not?
We are looking at a battle for our survival. Now, I don't want to be too dramatic there.
Well, that's pretty dramatic.
It is, but the what is happening on the ground is pretty dramatic. We have this planet which has been extremely generous to us. But now we are bursting at the seams of the planet. We are 6 billion now. We are going to get to somewhere around 10 or 11 billion for sure, even though population growth has generally begun to slow down.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is really not about the planet. The question is about us. The planet will survive.
Mm-hmm.
The question is how we will survive on that planet.
Now, you mean that there's going to be a big round rock here? It's going to be orbiting the sun, but what happens on its surface is the
sure,
question. Whether it's hospitable to human life and the life of everything that makes human life worthwhile.
Right. And when I say survival, I don't mean that, you know, humans are going to go extinct. No one really thinks that is likely. But the question is, what is the quality of life that we as inhabitants of this planet will be able to lead? And that is, when I say we, I don't mean just you or just me or just people here in Boston. Mm-hmm. I mean the 11 billion. And because if that quality of that life is varied to too much extremes, then you will have social tensions, you will have people moving from one place to the others. You're already seeing wars that people are saying are being caused by environment. Rwanda was probably the first of the conflicts that was majorly spurred by environmental scarcity.
Rwanda in Central Africa.
Because when people are deprived of their environmental livelihood, most people in the world are not like people in Boston. They live off the environment. They get their fuel wood from the forest. They get their food from the forest. They drink from the stream.
Let's keep it at this very high level, because I think this is what we need to know. We need to have it right in front of us. What you're saying then is that if we stay on the course we're on, it won't be a hospitable life for what portion of the world's population? We know right now that a lot of people live in fairly desperate circumstances. Are we talking about a third of Earth's population continuing to have a miserable environment, or might it be more than that?
Well, it's already more than that. It's already certainly more than that. There's probably about two-thirds of the world that lives in conditions that you and I would not want to live in. And in some ways, they subsidize the life that you and I lead.
Is that just because they're poor or because their environment has been destroyed?
The two are connected. Because they are poor, they put more pressures on their environment. Because their environment gets into problems, they get more poor because their livelihoods are directly linked to the environments they live in. Our livelihoods are directly linked to the environments we live in, except we just don't see it. The connections are far away. The table that we write on comes from wood somewhere. It doesn't come from wood in our backyard.
We're protected by affluence and distance.
We are protected by affluence and distance. Distance is shrinking, and distance is going to shrink.
Is it going to bring environmental depredation that would make life really not fun right into the laps of even affluent nations?
Unless we become fortresses, and we are becoming fortresses in some ways, because as the world shrinks, people know where the good life is. As their own life becomes more and more constrained, in this case by environmental compulsions, they're going to want to more and more go to where the constraints are not there, and you have an example right in front of you, me coming from Pakistan, now settled here in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. So if I'm reading you right, you're saying, yes, indeed, if we stay on this course, life may be something like a living hell here. Are you a fringe voice, Adil Najam? Are you a way out there, kind of a wild voice in the wilderness?
I don't think so. I think many voices like me will be there at Johannesburg. I should say I'm not a voice without hope. I'm not saying that it is inevitable. I think many things have happened in the last 30 years which suggest that we can change. The question is whether we will change.
We're going to dig into that. I know you were at Rio 10 years ago. Are you more or less hopeful today than you were in 1992?
That is a tough question. I am less hopeful in the sense that the last 10 years haven't seen what we thought they would see. The Rio promise wasn't really lived up to. On the other hand, I'm more hopeful because while governments haven't done what we thought they would do in terms of policy, people have. People in favelas in Brazil, people in Argentina have taken over.
We'll talk about that. Jack Beattie, here it is, a century sitting right in front of us, and the stakes sound awfully high.
They do, and I was recently looking at a British study that predicts that starting around 2050, the heating up of the planet could transform nature from a carbon sink into a carbon source, sort of fouling itself forever. That's the irreversible point of climate change. We're depositing 6 gigatons of carbon in nature a year, and it can only take 3, and that 3 is building up and sort of hastening oxidation in nature and pushing us to this irreversible point. It isn't our fate. It really is our choice, because Japanese manufacturers use a third the energy we do. You talk to people about this stuff, and they say, you know, we could have carbon taxes. Mm-hmm. We could stop taxing work and tax carbon. There are all sorts of things we can do. That's the question, though. Will we do them? Mm.
The stakes are as big as they could be. It sounds like we're talking about life on Earth in the 21st century. Does this century look environmentally survivable to you? Will our grandchildren, our children, have a livable world? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about life on Earth in the 21st century and asking if it will survive as we know it. Next Monday in Johannesburg, South Africa, about 20,000 people will be gathering for a new Earth Summit. That's 10 years after the much-heralded summit in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil in 1992. There's a lot on the table. There's been a lot of backsliding in the 10 years since Rio, but also a lot learned. Are we making too much of the environmental threat or too little? Are you confident that you are leaving a decent world for your children, for your grandchildren? Are we headed for a living hell here or a change of ways? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Our guest is Adil Najam. He's professor of international environmental policy at Boston University and co-author of Civic Entrepreneurship, Civil Society Perspectives on Sustainable Development. And Adil Najam, this sustainable development is the lead phrase of the conference in Johannesburg. And I guess there's an acknowledgement there that no, we cannot stop growth, but we have to grow in a way that's sustainable. Those things have often been described as being at odds. We all want to have economic growth. Have we found the formula? Is it out there? Are we close to it? Can we grow, have a happy economic life, and also a planet we want to live on?
What we found in this book, myself and Tariq Bannouri, is that there is no formula. What there are seeds.
Oh, great.
Seeds. No, but there are seeds. Just like there isn't a formula to growing a tree, there are seeds and they change wherever you put them. Every tree is different.
What do you mean by that, Adil?
What I mean that there are certain characteristics which are common in sustainable development wherever it happens. It's rooted in community. It builds on the capital of people. It grows not by growing bigger and taller. It grows by spewing off more seeds as more people mimic what you are doing. And therefore, the good news in the last 10 years is that sustainable development has happened. It hasn't happened in terms of policy. It has happened in terms of people who are pushed to the edge, taking over and saying, okay, we'll do it differently.
I'm not sure I know what you mean. China is stepping up economically in a huge way. Mm-hmm. Its energy consumption is skyrocketing. Mm-hmm. If our energy consumption at the top of the heap is not sustainable, surely China's is not either as it booms up in that way.
China is a very good example. There's something called the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, that I served on. And one of their findings of a recent report was very interesting. China's energy has gone up. But the way they are using energy is different from ours because they have been able to learn from us. They have been able to use, at least in some cases, somewhat better technology. Now, it isn't perfect, mm-hmm. but countries like India and China, particularly, you know, a billion each, mm-hmm. are going to be the great test cases. Whether they can learn from us, I don't mean our mistakes, but we had to do it earlier, so we learned the hard way. Mm. It doesn't matter to me whether my car spews a lot of gases or not. What matters to me is that the car should give me a certain performance. Mm-hmm. Now, if I can get the same performance from better technology, then I'm doing something good for the environment. In China and India are at that point where decisions can be made, where they can develop differently.
Adil Najam, do we have a prayer of accomplishing this in time, given the pace at which these kind of innovations are being adopted? Do we have a prayer?
Whether we have a prayer or not, we have no choice. And I still have great faith in human ingenuity that when push comes to shove, and it really is coming to shove, we will go up. Now, the problem really is, will we wait for some big catastrophe?
Jack Beatty says, the British report, it says 48 years from now, from this evening, the whole Earth turns from a carbon sink where it absorbs carbon and kind of keeps everything filtered and clean to a carbon source where it's a self-polluting planet.
Aha, right. But the important thing is the if. If we continue doing what we are doing. The fact is, in the last 500 years, we haven't continued doing what we were doing. We are a learning species. We can change, we can adapt, and this is a challenge for which we have to change, and we have to adapt. One of the big learnings of the last 10 years is that we are all in this together. that the whole planet, this is one of those things, it's not as if when things go bad, things will go bad in Africa but not in Latin America.
Mm-hmm.
It's really, for most of these essential earth functions, it's going to be the whole planet. And therefore, this is in some ways a uniting cause. The word sustainable development that you started with, that again I think is a great success story in some ways, even though it's a fluid word. 20 years ago, we talked about environment versus development.
Versus development. So if you had economic growth, your environment was going to pay.
Right. At Rio, the conference was on environment and development. We said, can we work on the two together? Here, the conference is on sustainable development and saying it's not about a choice between environment and development. It's not about slowing down growth. It is, can we grow differently?
Jack Beattie, you hear there the intellectual progress of the global conversation on the environment, but what's the learning curve look like to you? Is it steep enough? Are we making progress quickly enough?
Well, I am of the opinion, and I think our guest pretty much intimated that he was, that it's probably going to take something like an environmental Pearl Harbor or September 11th to get people to understand that this is perhaps the most profound challenge humanity has ever faced. And when we have political leaders who barely admit that this could happen, barely admit that global warming is happening, we are so far from that. But on the other hand, before September 11th, who ever thought about terrorism?
But gee, it's painful to think that we're just sitting here waiting for the big whack across the side of the head, the environmental version of 9/11. Adil Najam, let me ask you about what Jack's just raised. You raised it yourself. Is it going to take some hideous environmental event? And if so, what would that be? I mean, we read in the papers every day, and perhaps we're in some kind of panicked, overwrought state about this, but it's easy to look at the newspapers today and say, my gosh, look here, look there, look there. Are we already seeing environmental crises that we should be interpreting as wake-up calls, or is there some big one out there that hasn't come yet? What kind of thing might be the environmental 9/11?
I think, unfortunately, I hope it wouldn't. I have a feeling Jack is right, that it will take a dramatic event. I think you're also right. We see dramatic events every day. If 10,000 people become homeless in a span of an hour in a rainstorm in Bangladesh, now tell me that is not a calamity.
But what would the real catastrophic kind of event be? Give us an example.
I think the catastrophe will happen when it happens to us. There are many, many people out there to whom it is happening right now. So when, for example, every second, we lose an acre of land to deforestation. Now, tell me that's not a catastrophe.
Globally. In the United States, haven't I read that we're actually reforesting?
We are reforesting, though events today might take care of that too.
The forest fires in the West. But what kind? I still am at a loss to picture the event that would be the equivalent, let's say, for America of 9/11 in environmental terms.
Tom, if I might just put in the Bush report. I think in June, President Bush's EPA sent a representation about climate change to the UN. They were obliged to. And there, even in the Bush report, which, of course, Bush quickly said, well, that's the bureaucracy. It's not me. But even there, the Bush EPA was saying that sometime, and presumably after 2010, coastal areas in the United States could start to disappear, alpine meadows. So suppose the barrier islands in North Carolina just go over 5 years, or Cape Cod starts to, more
get skinny.
Beach erosion. Yeah, that's a Pearl Harbor. Yeah.
Adil Najam, is that the kind of Pearl Harbor you have in mind?
Yeah, the problem, not that it's a problem, but the challenge there is that these things happen very slowly. So there's something called environmental creep. Florida doesn't disappear in a day. Martha's Vineyard doesn't disappear in a day. It happens slowly.
Then how do you ever have that clanging bell event? Because we human beings adjust to changing circumstances. If Cape Cod gets skinnier, we adjust to that. If it takes a decade or 20 years, what's the thing that could be the wake-up call?
Prices could be one thing.
Prices
could be one thing.
Prices
for food? Certainly for food. We have done a fairly good job over the last 40 years of keeping up with food. Now we are losing that battle again. Population is overtaking food. Mm-hmm. Prices of food could be one. Prices of all environmental services, such as timber. could be another.
That even Americans, even Germans and Swedes couldn't afford what they thought of as the basics of life, even at the top of the economic pyramid.
And the fact is people have to see it to believe it. Now, people in Bangladesh have seen it. People in Germany saw it with acid rain. In some ways, because the U.S. is so bountiful in its resources, hasn't really seen that sort of an event like acid rain in Europe, for example. Mm-hmm.
Listeners, does the 21st century look environmentally survivable to you? We're talking about life on Earth in this new century tonight on the eve of the Johannesburg Earth Summit. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Andrew's on the line. Welcome, Andrew. You're on the air.
Thank you.
Sure.
Doesn't affluence also breed efficiency? For instance, an affluent man goes out and buys a more efficient car. He goes out and buys himself, hopefully, a Prius as opposed to an SUV, but that's a separate argument. But also, don't the sons and daughters of the affluent go on to become scientists and engineers versus a non-affluent farmer whose sons and daughters continue to become farmers and are stuck in perhaps cycles of poverty? So isn't raising economics of developing countries one of our best bets? Also, another example, people were get flooded out every year. Farms get washed away. People are left homeless. Thousands of people are killed. And this is not the situation in China. This was the situation in 1920 Tennessee and in 1920 Washington State until the construction of the Tennessee Valley Authority and the Grand Coulee Dam.
Both of your points, Andrew, really make an argument for getting in there and breeding economic growth and getting in there with our hands on the planet and fixing it up. Let me put that to Adil Najam. And Andrew, thank you for your call. I guess the first one really is a tricky question. Does affluence breed efficiency? As Andrew points out, it could. You could buy a Prius, but you could also buy a Lincoln Navigator, and I think we've sold an awful lot more of that ilk than fuel-efficient cars. What is, and we're talking here about development, sustainable development, what's the trade-off between affluence and sustainability? Or is there a trade-off?
Yes, affluence can breed efficiency. Affluence can get you many, many good things.
But it hasn't bred efficiency so far. Americans are the biggest consumers of global resources.
And nor do I think is the word growth is very good, because the growth talks about linear growth. And therefore, the more nuanced development is much more important. And therefore, what is important is livelihoods. Can people lead fulfilling lives? Can they have fulfilling livelihoods on the basis of a balance with their environment?
Oh, wait, you're raising something big here then. I thought that the evolution from Rio to Johannesburg was that we went from growth versus environment to the combined thing. But you're saying not growth, but development.
Right.
Are you saying we're all going to be jute farmers and live in hand-woven pants? I mean, growth, when you say sustainable development to Americans, that means Greenspan talks about growth, talks about sales of consumer products. Are you saying that's not on? That's not what it is?
No, growth in itself is neither good nor bad. Growth is good only when it gets you something. It gets you a quality of life that you want. And in some ways, our quality of life is actually lesser than our growth. And we see that many of us sort of trapped in the livelihoods that we are. Mm-hmm. The point I'm making is that affluence is not necessarily the bad actor here. The issue is whether it works in harmony with the environmental resources, with the limits of the planet. You cannot mess with the planet beyond a certain limit.
And yet we are. Adil Najam, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation Daniel Esty. He's director of the Center for Environmental Law and Policy at Yale University. Like you, he attended the 1992 Rio Earth Summit. Good evening and welcome, Daniel Esty.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
It's great to have you. Daniel Esty, you have written that one of the greatest challenges is fostering global cooperation. Have we seen that in the last 10 years? Rio was supposed to be the big kickoff for that. And if we haven't, are you hopeful that it can come out of Johannesburg in some new or different way?
I think one of the big disappointments over the last 10 years is how little has been done to organize us in ways that take seriously the ecological interdependence that you all have been talking about for the last 20 minutes. And I think that really presents a very serious challenge, and I'm afraid that it's very late in the day for anything positive to come from Johannesburg. It's been a meeting that's not been well organized, and frankly, as Adil has pointed out, the real progress has come not from governments. And yet the triumph of Rio was that governments did get organized, and they at least laid out a game plan. They didn't follow it, but they did lay out some plans, and I don't see that coming out of Johannesburg.
But you describe Rio as a triumph, but when we look back at that, we see, you know, air that's just as dirty, oceans that are just as stretched, treaties that perhaps had their genesis in Rio that are still not ratified.
Tom, I think you need to take the problem apart a little bit more, and frankly, it's a more nuanced picture.
Mm-hmm.
In the developed world, in North America and Europe, the picture has actually gotten quite a bit better on a number of fronts. The air in Los Angeles is much cleaner today than 10 years ago. Denver was just taken off the EPA watch list as a city with air pollution problems.
Mm-hmm.
We have more Americans with better quality water than ever before. We have a higher degree of our sewage being treated properly than ever before. So with regard to a significant number of problems, we are doing much better today, as is Europe.
Is that a hopeful sign for the planet, or is it an extraordinary effort that only an affluent nation can make? How should we interpret those gains?
Well, I think you do have to then look at a separate picture in the developing world, and frankly, the trend lines there are much less favorable. With regard to, again, the critical issues of air and water across much of the developing world, again, as you've talked about in China and India, Bangladesh and elsewhere, the trend lines are negative. And the pressures of population growth and of development and of new economic pressures have really resulted in a worsening situation.
Now,
I want to separate out a third category, if I can, and that is global scale problems.
Mm-hmm.
These are problems like climate change, protection of biodiversity, fisheries in the ocean, which are inescapably international. That is to say, countries cannot handle them on their own, because of the spillovers from one country onto the next or into what we call the global commons, the shared space of the oceans and the atmosphere.
How are we doing in tackling that tier, that global tier?
In that regard, we have got one problem, protection of the ozone layer, where we've made some real progress in the last decade. But this other set of issues, climate change, biodiversity, fisheries, we are seeing continued deterioration.
Well, what's the problem on that front, and where's the hope lie?
Well, I think the problem is that from any one country's point of view, spending a lot of money to address one of these problems doesn't look very good from a raw cost-benefit point of view.
Hmm.
You spend a lot of money on your own, and you get back benefits that are small because you have to share those benefits with everyone else on the planet.
This sounds like the Bush White House critique.
Well, it's the Bush White House critique to some degree, but it's not a very good long-term answer in so far as the real response has to be getting cooperation, because you can't simply look at your own benefits and say, gee, that doesn't look good against the costs. What you need is to make sure everyone is moving arm in arm to address these problems, and that your benefit calculation is really the sum total of benefits across the world.
So what's going to push countries beyond that narrow self-interest perspective that never gets them to the table for cooperation?
Well, I think it's understanding the logic of reciprocity and of taking seriously our ecological interdependence. And you all were talking about what kind of a crisis it would take to get us focused on this. And I think we can look back at the economic crises of the Great Depression and World War II that followed, which did in fact wake us up to our economic interdependence and resulted in a significant investment in the late 40s into the 50s and beyond in international economic institutions designed to foster cooperation and to ensure that countries did find ways to collaborate in addressing economic challenges.
But it's still ominous to think of the equivalent of a world war sitting out there necessary to adequately wake us up. We're talking tonight about life on Earth in the 21st century. Will it survive as we know it? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight on the eve of the Johannesburg Earth Summit about life on Earth in the 21st century. Will our grandchildren, our children, have a livable world? Can we have economic growth and environmental health? Are we wired as a species to respond to this problem? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're lucky to be joined tonight by Adil Najami, professor of international environmental policy at Boston University, and by Daniel Esty, director of the Center for Environmental Law and Policy at Yale University. You're welcome to join the conversation as well. Laura's calling from New Berlin, Wisconsin. Welcome, Laura. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you for having this most worthy of all possible discussion subjects and to answer a couple of your rhetorical questions at the outset, Tom. I believe way too little attention is paid to this dire topic, and I most emphatically believe, yes, we are headed toward a living hell. My question is this: why are not all resources on the planet marshaled to, as soon as possible, stabilize and ideally reduce the population? I'm reminded of the rallying cry of population control advocates that every cause is a lost cause without population control. And I think anything short of that is a decision toward a protracted suicide. So I have never understood, and even tonight we just have this foregone conclusion that we're headed to 9, possibly 11, 12 billion. I literally shudder contemplating those thoughts. So I can't understand when there are those on the opposite side that say we're already quadruple sustainable population levels.
Right.
Why not every resource is focused on stabilization and then reduction, and not through abortion, but rather education and contraception.
Laura, let us go right at that, because those numbers, as you say, are startling. If we're already taxing the Earth at this rate with a population of now 6 billion, what will it mean if we potentially nearly double that? Laura, thank you very much for your call. But Adil Najam, address the population issue with us. Does it have to go to 9, 10, 11 billion? Is there any way of stopping it? We know that the growth rate's already come down, but is it already baked in the cake of global demographics?
Yeah, it has to go. It has to go there, short of a calamity like a war or something. It will go to 11. Population is more complex than that. The Earth can sustain 11. The question is,
did you say
11,
can or cannot?
Can. The question is, at what level? At the levels of your and my consumption, it can't even sustain 3. At the level of Bangladesh, it can certainly sustain 11, and that's really the choice. I think population, the good news on population is that the curve is beginning to be taken. Growth rates are, in fact, coming down, but it will really go to 10 or 11 before it stabilizes and comes down. The other thing on population one has to be very careful is that number alone does not tell you the picture. I have a brother who lives in Pakistan. He has a son. I have a son. Mm-hmm. My son is going to consume on average between 12 to 70 times more of each environmental resource than my brother's son, simply by factor of what sort of
lifestyle
he's going to live. Right? So population numbers alone don't tell the whole picture, but you're right and your caller is right. It is a very important piece in the puzzle. The good news is the curve has been taken. The bad news is you aren't really going to stop the 10 or 11.
And to Laura's point, there's a lot to talk about here, but to Laura's point, and Daniel Esty, jump in here, is there no way that we can pull the reins and somehow put the brakes on to stop population shy of those enormous numbers?
Well, I think you've got a population issue that does have, as was just pointed out, some positive signs. That is, the growth rate is slowing. And again, I think if you differentiated between the developed and developing world, you'd see some sharp differences. In Northern Europe, you actually have negative population growth. In fact, across most of Europe, in some countries, very serious negative population growth. In North America, we've got a pretty steady population, really growing only from immigration at this point. So we've got a population situation that is sharply divided, and I think it argues again for a more differentiated approach, a more targeted approach. And I'm going to say something our caller may not like very much, but I think one of the issues is we've got to avoid thinking there are simple problems or simple solutions and really dig into the details, which is tough business and stuff that in many cases politicians don't like. But it is this sort of more refined approach to environmentalism I think offers real promise.
But Daniel, let's dig in on details right here on population. First of all, I need to understand, do you agree with Adil Najam that even if we dig in and do our best, we're headed towards something like 10 billion total?
I think 10 billion is a reasonable place to see us topping out. I think 11 is a possibility, and I think we could do a little better than that with a serious effort.
And there's no
doubt that it's a real issue and it deserves real attention.
Let me ask you this then. Does 10 or 11 billion, is that assuming that could it go even higher if there aren't population control efforts undertaken?
No, it could go higher, but I think the point that was made earlier is really the correct one, which is how do we address the need to keep lifestyles going along with population. That is to say, can we produce the food we need? Do we become more efficient faster at food production, or is population outstripping us?
But Adil Najam says, yes, we can support a population of 11 billion if we live in the lifestyle of people of Bangladesh. I've spent a year in South Asia, 10 years in Asia. For most Americans, as Adil points out, the reality of a Bangladeshi lifestyle would be absolutely staggering.
Well, I don't think
that what it's going to take?
No, there's no suggestion, I think, that a population of 10 billion reduces American lifestyle to that of Bangladesh or anything close. I think the reality is the suffering will go on in the developing world. This isn't to say that it's acceptable, but it's not an immediate threat to the United States. And I think you put on the table something earlier that's worth picking up again, mm-hmm. and that is there are some really positive signs, the possibility of technology breakthroughs. The potential to harness the power of the information age and really marry computer breakthroughs and remote sensing and a whole set of high-tech opportunities to the environmental challenge.
Good Lord, if we ever wanted anything to work, we want that to work right now. Adil Najam?
Very quickly, A, to recognize that the Bangladeshi is, in fact, subsidizing my lifestyle. Mm-hmm. B, if we want to bring it to 9, what do we do? Indira Gandhi, the Prime Minister, former Prime Minister of mm-hmm. India, had it right. Development is the best contraceptive. Mm-hmm. The difference between 4 children and 5 children for a farmer in Bangladesh is not the difference between 4 stomachs to feed and 5 stomachs to feed. It's the difference between 8 hands to work with mm-hmm. or 10 hands to work with. People have children because they need children for their development.
So it takes economic development, but we have to have development that doesn't increase energy use.
But we know from all over the world, when people get development, the population growths fall even more dramatically. And that's what happened in North America. That's what's happened in Europe. And that's what's beginning to happen in some of Southeast Asia.
Jack Beattie, there are a lot of complexities in here, but still those end result figures are stark. 10, 11 billion. It already feels like a crowded planet.
It does, and we heard from Professor Najam that how much more energy his son uses here than his brother's son in Pakistan. Mm-hmm. But suppose his son didn't have tax on his income, so there was no income tax, but there was tax on every use of carbon. Well, suddenly, without any government planning or the marketplace would there'd be amazing changes, wouldn't there be?
His son might become the entrepreneur that builds doesn't pollute.
And you could set it up so that it would be revenue neutral. You could set it up so that it wouldn't hurt the poor. But suddenly the market would be sending us all what is really the real cost of energy. You know, it isn't just sustainable development. It's real development.
But so far, governments are rewarded for shielding Americans from that kind of choice or from making that kind of policy change.
Well, they are, but this is where you get into the issue of, you know, disaster, the educative disaster, or you get into the issue where just suddenly people are going to demand from simply their own education, from programs like this, they're going to say, wait a minute, we have to think about posterity. Mm-hmm. You know, that used to be a big word in America. Mm-hmm. It's practically disappeared. We're not just living for ourselves.
And we're not talking about the distant future either. Jack, Adil, Daniel, we have so many people who want to join this conversation. Let's turn to them. David's on the line. Welcome, David. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
And I'd like to submit that we're seeing the beginnings of what will be the 9/11 or the Pearl Harbor of environmental catastrophe for the United States. I think it will be fire. I mean, we're seeing, you know, 2 or 3 more summers of dry, hot weather, and, you know, you could conceivably see the Pacific Northwest on fire. And that may be the wake-up call if, you know, Yellowstone disappears. And
so it looks like potentially the Armageddon is here to you in those western fires,
yes,
David.
Yes, I think right now, if you look at something like the Biscuit Fire, which is, you know, 400,000 acres, something of that sort, I mean, that's staggering. And if you give a few more years of these conditions, and you could have fires that are just of unimaginable size. And
let's put it to our guests. And, David, thank you for your call. Daniel Esty, how about it? It's so hard for ordinary people to look out at calamities around the world and assess which one is the signal of doom. Are Western fires just a forest management problem, or are these an environmental red flag?
I think the difficulty is we're looking for very short-term signals of very long-term trends. On the other hand, the fires are real and tangible, and they do provide something of a wake-up call. And I think there are a number of people who might not have been paying attention to this environmental challenge, but for that signal in their backyard or on their television screens. So I think there is some hope that this will help get people going, just as in past years when we've had hot summers. And people have said, well, maybe climate change is real and we better take that seriously.
So it gets our attention. Phil's calling from Woodbury, Minnesota. Hi, Phil. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have a gigantic issue I would like to bring up, and I'll just talk today for a minute. And
make it compact for us, Phil.
There is a book called The Millennial Project, Colonizing the Galaxy in 8 Easy Steps. It's a rather formidable title, but the first chapter deals with ocean colonization as a technical solution to the global warming problem. It uses free and abundant solar energy extracted in the form of ocean thermal power in floating cities to completely replace all fossil fuel consumption, which solves the carbon problem, and in addition uses the deep cold water, which is nutrient-rich, to do high-intensity farming, aquaculture, and sink any carbon waste from that food production back into the sediment layers. So each city forms.
Phil, I'm going to take that. Your line's a little thin, but I think we got the heart of it. And I want to ask our guests about that. Thank you for your call. I guess at two levels. First, Adil Najam, let's go straight at what Phil's saying. He's describing, and this sounds sci-fi, but maybe there's something to it. We abandon land for ocean and we live off of ocean energy and ocean nutrients. Address that and then go beyond that. Daniel Estes has raised it, but how much can we look to technology, green technology, to help us solve our problem?
I think technology will have a role to play. It will have a very important role to play, but it is not going to be the silver bullet.
Are we going to live in floating colonies on the sea?
I hope not. I hope not. I mean, for some reason, that doesn't sound very exciting to me. Technology is going to have a role to play, but the real role is going to be our attitude towards Earth, what Jack was talking about. The Africans have this wonderful saying, we have not inherited the planet from our parents, we have borrowed it from our children.
Does it mean Americans are going to have to live a radically different lifestyle?
I think 9/11 did part of that. 9/11 brought the rest of the world to us. Environment is doing the other part of that.
Are we going to have to surrender those cars? Are we going to have to, live in grass huts?
I think it's going to make us realize that we have to live with our neighbors. Our neighbors, not just other countries, but our neighbors, the nature. Our neighbor, the planet.
Daniel Estes, please.
I think Jack really got us on the right track. Mm-hmm. The question is, how do we change behavior in ways that people don't revolt against?
Mm-hmm.
And I think slowly bringing on board economic price signals that tell people what's the environmentally preferable way to go could be enormously helpful. Not only would it tell each of us what kind of a car to buy by signaling what's going to be environmentally less damaging, but I think it would also engage America's enormously strong entrepreneurial spirit in getting people thinking about alternatives. It would signal to the capital markets and to the venture capital mm-hmm. community that there's an opportunity to profit here. Mm-hmm. And I think once we get those forces moving, we really will see a spiral in a positive direction of new inventions and innovation and creativity.
Let's
and
hope
people
so.
Moving that direction.
Daniel Estes, that prescribes a leadership role for government, maybe more than we've seen so far. Our time is running down, but I want to thank you so much for joining us tonight, Daniel.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Daniel Estes is director of the Center for Environmental Law and Policy at Yale University. And Adil Najam, it's just been great having you. Thank you so much for coming in. Adil Najam is professor of international environmental policy at Boston University. Jack Beattie, we've just got a minute left, but there it is. A leadership role that may have to go beyond a simple market dictate here.
Yes, although that would be such a huge contribution of leadership. A president is educator again, but just to repeat that African proverb, we have not inherited the planet from our parents, we have borrowed it from our children.
We have borrowed it from our children. We'll be watching what goes on in Johannesburg next week, but as our guests say, it's all about what happens closer to home and what happens in cooperation globally. Jack, thanks for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Log on to onpointradio.org and click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is W.